Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire House Committee gets to work today on a bill that supporters call the next evolution in school choice. The state Senate has already passed SB 193 to create what are called education savings accounts. It's basically cash put in a special account for parents to use toward alternative education expenses, whether funds for a homeschooler to buy a computer or money to help pay for private school. Half a dozen other states already have these education savings accounts, but most are aimed at helping low-income kids or those with disabilities. New Hampshire's bill is broader. It allows most students access to the money, and that's led some House lawmakers to worry about cost to state and local districts. Today in The Exchange, another chapter in the school choice debate. What questions do you have about this? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests in studio. Kate Baker is here, Executive Director of the Children's Scholarship Fund, NH, a nonprofit charity scholarship organization. And Kate, welcome back. Nice to see you.
I'm so happy to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dan Vallone, Director of Engagement for Reaching Higher NH, an organization that advocates for public schools. And Dan Vallone, good to meet you. Thank you.
Great to be here.
And also joining us from Colorado, Micah Wixom, Policy Analyst for the Education Commission of the State, which basically studies education policy around the country. And Micah, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
So, Micah, what are supporters of these education savings accounts in other states hoping that they'll accomplish? What's the goal?
So when you're talking to people, or when we hear people talking about education savings accounts, two of the things that come up most commonly are flexibility and choice. And the idea with education savings accounts is that, similar to a voucher program, these funds can be used to for students to attend a private school. But the idea is that with education savings accounts, there are more options as in addition to private school. So it could be tutoring services or online course fees or something like that. And so the idea really is that in addition to providing parents choice, they also provide greater flexibility with how the monies can be used.
And how common are these, Micah, around the country? You and your colleagues have done some research on this.
Right. So while we have certainly heard a lot about them, especially over the past 2 years, there at last count, there are actually just 5 programs in the country. And one of them in Nevada is actually on hold after a court decision which found the funding mechanism unconstitutional. And I know the legislature is working on that during this legislative session.
Yeah,
so there are 5 programs.
I've got your chart in front of me. And so the 5 are Arizona, Florida, Mississippi, Tennessee, and as you said, Nevada's program is on hold. And you guys have also written, Micah, that at least half a dozen other states looked at this last year but decided not to go for it. How come?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I mean, I think one of the things that comes up a lot are concerns about monies potentially being used for religious education. There are also concerns that there might be less. You know, these are concerns that are very similar with arguments you hear around straight voucher program. Concerns that there might not be as much accountability over how the public, how these public monies are being used, and so on.
Tell us a little bit, Mike, about the very first education savings account in Arizona, how that rolled out and why that got started.
Well, that started because they previously had a voucher program that had some legal challenges. And so there's an organization in Arizona called the Goldwater Institute, and they had worked with the legislature to craft a program that was structured a little bit differently than a voucher program, and that's how education savings accounts were born. And I think that was started 2010 or 11.
Let's bring our listeners from New Hampshire in because there's a lot of similarities and some big differences with what New Hampshire is trying to do. And Kate, to you first, please, why do you think this is so important?
Well, being a boots on the ground person who answers the telephone at Children's Scholarship Fund, where we provide, you know, K through 12 scholarships for families who are looking for education alternatives, I can tell you that the sentiment from the people calling us is really that they have a child in a special circumstance who needs to do something different, whether it's a special needs child who needs a more hands-on environment, or it's a child being bullied who just needs to be in a different building. People really do, you know, one size doesn't really fit all, and we kind of all agree on that. And so I can tell you that there's a need in New Hampshire for people to be able to access education opportunities, particularly families with financial challenges. And so for me, I think anything that we can do to make the education that's the right fit for the child a possibility, I'm for it.
So who would be eligible for these education savings accounts under this SB 193, Kate? Because in these other states that Micah has followed, It's pretty strict. A student has to have a disability. The student has to have an IEP, an individualized education program, because of some sort of learning disability. In Arizona, the child has to attend a school assigned a letter grade of D or F, so a failing school. So pretty strict in some other states. Who would be eligible here in New Hampshire?
In New Hampshire, it is considered universal. Any child that's currently in a public school enrolled that wanted to do something different would be able to do that.
What about kids in public school who may need extra educational supports? For example, I have a friend whose son was struggling in math. He's in middle school. So yeah. She said, look, this just he needs more help. So she paid for a tutor,
right,
which is pretty expensive.
Yeah.
He stayed in the public school, but he has this math tutor. Would he be eligible for this?
I think a family needs to actually leave the public school to then get and utilize the funds. So
now,
it
why
would
is
be,
that?
For an example, like if a family wants to homeschool their special needs child, for example, they could use these funds to purchase all of the therapies. So I have a family who I know goes to a private school in Manchester currently who has a special needs child who does receive some child find money, federal money, through the district, about $150 a year they receive to pay for one of the child's therapies. So in this situation, that family could apply for an education savings account and get that small amount of state adequacy dollars put in the account for them. They could use it to pay for part of their private school tuition, and then they could also use it to purchase the therapies that he needs for his special needs.
And Dan, I can see you want to jump in. One more question, though, about who get this money and who cannot. Karen, on our web post, wrote, many homeschool kids play public school sports or attend after-school clubs. Would parents be able to keep their funds for homeschooling and still send their children to public school sports and clubs?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I could answer that
still
to know
new.
The logistics of it. I do know that dual enrollment like that is a choice that the district makes. So, for example, right now in our scholarship program, we use a student identification number to verify that they're actually leaving public and going to private. When a child is a homeschooler and dual enrolled, they don't count because the state adequacy dollars are not paid for that child. So I don't know, honestly. In those situations, it's a little bit strange. It depends on what the district, I think, is doing
and Karen,
how they would qualify at the state level.
Karen also had a question that similar to what I just asked you. She says, if a child attends public school, like my friend whose son needed a math tutor, but is homeschooled for a single course, would the parent be able to use public money to pay for that course? And it sounds like the answer is no. You have to be out of the public schools in order to access this
because
money.
Then you would double cost, right?
Right.
And the point is that these are children for whom we're already paying for, right, somewhere. And then the money can follow the child if they want to do something else. Although I have to admit, I like that idea of a la carte. And I know that for homeschoolers or children in another district, for example, Central High School will let you take a course and pay a course tuition. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't do that because, for example, our current scholarships we can use to give to a child to go to another district. And so if you wanted to purchase services after you were, say, out, right, if you then wanted to purchase services or pay tuition at a public school, you could use your education savings account card for that.
Well,
does that make sense?
Dan, what is your problem with these accounts? You've had a lot to say. Your organization put out a whole analysis saying this is a bad idea.
Sure, absolutely. And we've raised a series of concerns. But fundamentally for us, context matters. And the states that you just listed that have or have considered these programs, Arizona, Tennessee, Nevada, Mississippi, Florida, these are states that have had real troubles with serving all kids in their state and providing a great education. New Hampshire's public school students are, if not the best, consistently among the top two or three in the country. On by any metric of academic achievement, our students simply blow the other states away. It's quite phenomenal. And so in the context of New Hampshire's unique circumstances, our concern is that this program doesn't actually create real choice, because choice isn't about public versus private versus homeschool. It's not about the building where a child learns. Choice is about putting the student first and ensuring that every single student has access to an education that speaks to his or her unique needs and gifts and abilities. It's about creating that pathway where students can drive their own learning because they're excited, because they love what they're doing, and they can't wait to unlock that next idea and share and show what they're learning. And New Hampshire is a national leader at delivering this kind of personalized learning, and it looks differently across our state. But what we could be doing right now is, instead of thinking about how do we basically fix the pie and then divide it up between public versus private, we could be building on the incredible momentum we have behind personalized learning. If a community wants to build out their STEM programming, let's work together to figure out what are the barriers in place to implementing that kind of program, like a STEAM Ahead in Manchester. And let's remove them. Let's work together. If a high school wants to make sure that every single student has access to college coursework so they graduate with an associate's degree, we can do that. The bottom line here is I could talk all day about how we can expand flexibilities within the public school system, but when it comes to creating real choice in public education, we are really only constrained in New Hampshire by our imagination and our willingness to put kids first.
Well, NHPR's Morning Edition team has looked a lot at this, speaking to the sponsor of this bill, John Reagan of Deerfield, also speaking to Carl Ladd, head of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association. Let's hear now from Carl Ladd talking about sort of what you mentioned, Dan, the idea of choice and flexibility can happen within the current system. Carl Ladd questioning here why the state needs to adopt this approach at all.
We do more for school choice now than we ever did when I attended school. We have dual enrollment programs with colleges. We have advanced placement courses that were never available when I went to school. We have more career pathways through the career and technical education centers in our state. We do more for public school choice than we ever did before, and we should be funding and supporting those efforts that are already underway instead of trying to undermine it in this very risky and possibly costly, litigious bill that is not going to provide for those kids who are in poverty, who are struggling, and it's not going to help their parents.
Well, and that's Carl Ladd again, head of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association. But Dan, we heard earlier from Kate, you know, just at the Children's Scholarship Fund, she gets calls all the time from parents who say, look, it's not working for me. So, you know, I hear you and I hear Carl Ladd saying it's great. There's so much good stuff going on. But you can't deny the fact that some kids are not making it in the traditional system.
No, and first off, I applaud Ms. Baker and the work that she does to help kids. I mean, and there are some incredible stories out there, and those are families that we always want to see succeed. We want every kid to see it. And again, it's not about the building. It's not about the location. But the challenge that I think we have as a state is to look at how do we expand choice for all students? Because that's what real opportunity is about. And so when I think about that is we can work together to figure out what additional flexibilities does a school need to provide every single student with a unique pathway. Those students who are struggling or who are being challenged by their current learning environment, how do we make it so that they can have a new and unique experience at school? Because when we invest in public education, we benefit thousands of kids. And I think about this way. So at last month's state board meeting, there was a parent from Sanborn who came to talk about her son's experience with the PACE. Sanborn is a PACE district. It's a performance assessment for competency education. And she talked about how her son, who in kindergarten was really struggling, filled with anxiety, often like bursting into tears because he was not having a great experience. And through the personalized learning approach that Sanborn has adopted, the teachers worked with him to use his passion for animals as the vehicle to deliver his learning and to help him feel like he's in charge of his own education. And so now in the third grade, the mom talked about how he is a confident learner, filled with a joy for going to school and coming home sharing about how he's learning all about Jane Goodall and her experiences and how he has choices with how he shows his teacher what he's learned. That's an innovative approach that New Hampshire is leading as a state, and we can do and we must do more to bring that to every school and to bring similar concepts so that every student has that kind of unique and exciting experience.
Kate, go ahead.
I think both of these things happening at the same time makes the most sense, because then we really are doing exactly what Carl is talking about and Dan is talking about, which is creating the possibility for individualizing the education for every child. I mean, by allowing parents to customize their children's education and be able to purchase courses or purchase online in addition to attending a building, I mean, isn't that what everybody's just saying right here?
But under this bill, correct me if I'm wrong, if my kid is in the public school system, and both of my kids are, full disclosure, this would not help me pay for tutoring, which I had to pay for at one point for one of my children. It would not help me, you know, buy my older son a laptop so that he can, you know, access those courses. So
maybe that's something I should bring back to the legislature and tell them that, you know, we've learned from talking to all of the constituents that this is something that people want to be able
some help paying for that
to do with this. So, I mean, I think that might be a reasonable option. You know, it's the reverse, right? If you wanted to purchase things from the school, perhaps you could. Maybe it just needs to be flipped, where if you were to be a education savings account holder, then you could purchase the tuition at your public school and purchase the tutoring with your education savings account. So again, I think that the idea is right.
Except the money for these comes from the adequacy grant, and it's about $3,500. I think that's about the max. So the public schools here wouldn't give me anything additional because I've already got my $3,500, right? So that's the issue.
Enough to be able to do what we're coming up with as an idea.
No, and I think the real challenge with SB 193 is that it stops education from being a collaborative process. It essentially assigns a number value to a student and says that's our only obligation as a state is to write a check and that's it. And we know that's not true. That is fundamentally not the New Hampshire way. And so we should be, again, looking at how can we work together as a state and as local communities to build out flexibilities for schools, to make that experience unique for students. And I think about in Berlin right now, they're piloting an initiative to have home visitations. And actually, NHPR did some great reporting and coverage of Berlin's, Voices from Berlin. And their superintendent talked about how what they're doing is really helping their whole district come together and learn about the transition from talking to parents to talking with parents, making this a real united effort.
Lots of people want to jump into our conversation. Let's go to them now. Patricia joins us from Plainfield. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I am. I've had lots of experience. I've just worked in the school system for 3 years, and I know other people that have their kids in the schools. And I'm supporting a voucher program that this bill would support. I know that these guys on here are lobbyists, and they're eloquent. But isn't it about the money? $15,000 to $19,000 per annum per student. Why is it spent in your building necessarily? Why don't we have more choices? And the IEP for the special ed kids, just a bunch of paperwork.
So, Patricia, I'm not really sure what your basic point is for our guest today. Can you just clarify, please?
I wish they were not advocating against school choice, both your guests.
Okay, and Patricia, maybe it's not clear. Kate Baker is a huge supporter of school choice, and maybe we should have made that clear in the beginning. Go ahead, Kate.
Yeah, Patricia, I'm here for you, sister. I definitely think that parents should be able to have any options that they want for their children, and children should be able to choose whatever option is the right fit for them. And under this education savings account, in that case, the money would follow the child. And we're totally supporting that side. So maybe, Laura, I should talk some more.
Well, so, Patricia, glad to clarify that for you. And after a short break, Mike, I'm going to ask you how familiar some of the arguments that you're hearing here in New Hampshire are from different states around the country. All that coming up, plus your comments, of course. So stay with us.
It's
it's not a reaction that you can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah. This week on Something Wild, prepare for the heebie-jeebies.
Garter snakes are more cold tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. Winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
Chris Martin has the 411 on our slithering neighbors. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild, wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, cool stuff.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the debate around school choice and specifically a bill that would create education savings accounts. We're finding out more and taking your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We had three guests with us. Dan Vallone, Director of Engagement for Reaching Higher NH, an organization that advocates for public schools. Kate Baker is here, Executive Director of the Children's Scholarship Fund, NH, a nonprofit charity scholarship organization that helps parents with school choice. Also joining us from Colorado, Micah Wixom, policy analyst for the Education Commission of the States. And Micah, let's go back to you. And you heard some of the arguments here in the studio about New Hampshire's proposal. Do these sound familiar or do they sound different?
Yeah, very familiar. Definitely things that we're hearing in other states. And one thing that stood out to me that I wanted to that I haven't heard discussed as much, but I'd love to jump in with this, is two things. One is, one of the issues that comes up sometimes around school choice programs are how these affect students in rural areas. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, if you're talking about a voucher program where it would allow students to go to a private school, sometimes there aren't really any private schools close by, and so that can sometimes be an issue, especially in states with a large rural area. So that's something that I think is an interesting argument that comes up as well. Another thing that has come up recently that I've heard is Texas has been debating a similar education savings account bill, and similar to New Hampshire, it would allow homeschooled students to participate. Not all states' ESAs allow that, but some. But New Hampshire is considering one that would, and Texas was considering one as well. And one thing that was kind of interesting is there was this large contingent of homeschooled families who said, we actually don't want this bill because it would have more government oversight than we want in our homeschooling. And I thought that was interesting as well.
We should talk about the accountability piece in a moment. But to the rural point, that is something that comes up, Kate, when it comes to school choice proposals of various kinds that, you know, Mike is right. In parts of New Hampshire, there isn't a lot of school choice. So how would this benefit a kid in, you know, some rural corner of the state as much as it would in Nashua or Manchester, where there's a lot of choice?
I mean, that really is the impetus for including homeschoolers and alternative education providers in this, where it could be tutors or therapies or, you know, Dan mentioned earlier that having school choice is not collaborative, and I really think of it as the opposite, right? If you think about this, you're including independent schools, public schools, education providers, therapeutic providers. That seems more collaborative to me, right? And if you're thinking about a rural area, that will give families, right, more flexibility. For example, what if you're in a rural area in a public school, your child's being bullied, right? And the school's done everything they can. The teachers have done everything they can. You just need to do something else with your child. Doesn't this create that opportunity for you? There also is a study by Brookings Institute, and I think they're fairly moderate in there. They were talking about who could benefit from school choice, and they actually did the mapping. And in New Hampshire, it does say that about, I think, 80% of the people in New Hampshire. So 82% of families have access to a private elementary school within a 5-mile radius nationwide. And then their New Hampshire figure was that 70% of people in New Hampshire have access to a private school within 5 miles. So, I mean, while yes, that's always going to be a challenge, I think this does more rather than less for people in rural areas.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, and I think just to clarify what I said was that this bill, unfortunately, positions the state as not being a collaborative process in the educational experience for all of our kids. And again, it reduces our role as a community here in New Hampshire to assign and a value to students. And I think that that's something that should be very concerning. But with respect
what
to the—
What do you mean by that, Dan?
So
that's sort of broad
this
language.
This essentially says that all the state has to do is write a check for essentially $3,200 per student, and that's it. That constitutes all of our obligation as New Hampshire, as a state, to that student. As it stands currently, we say that we stand behind our communities. We invest along with them. The Department of Education works alongside of all of our school districts to make sure that students have access to as many possible pathways as they can. That's the AP coursework that we heard Dr. Ladd talk about. That's the college courses. That's the career and technical centers. And actually, circling back to an earlier point that was made, I think something that is really incredible and that we deeply value here in New Hampshire is that students who are currently in homeschool and in private school have access to public schools. Because at the end of the day, public schools belong to the kids and the families of the community. And so even if that student is being homeschooled right now, that school is there for them. And it's always going to be, because that is the fundamental value of public education.
Well, so the argument against homeschoolers has been made. But Dan, couldn't you say that, you know, let's say if I homeschooled my kids, which I don't, you know, I'm already paying into the public school system. I'm paying taxes for public schools. So if I wanted to homeschool my kids and use that $3,200 or $3,300 to help out with that, couldn't you say that I'm already paying in, so don't I deserve some sort of a benefit from that?
I think that everybody who...
Because right now, if I'm homeschooling, I'm not getting anything.
Well, I think that everybody who pays into the system, and actually, even if you're not an active taxpayer, I think everybody who participates in the community deserves to experience benefits from public education, and I would argue that they do. I think that our public schools provide so many values beyond simply the education that happens within the classroom. They are at the forefront of addressing our state's opioid and mental health crisis. They are, in many ways, the heart and soul of communities. I grew up in Epping, New Hampshire, which is a pretty small town. It was even smaller when I was growing up there. And the school was the meeting point. I mean, we just had all of our state's town hall meeting days. How many of those took place at a school? How many of those towns is the school, this central meeting place where people come together to talk about their community? So everybody benefits when we invest and support in a rich public school offering that where every student has a chance to thrive.
Here's an email from Aslin, who says, why is it fair to local property taxpayers to divert state money to private prep schools? And I've got a couple emails on that point. So to you first, Kate, and then I want to hear from Mike on that as well.
I can tell you as a property taxpayer, right, that I know I'm paying for my neighbor's kids' education, right, by paying my property taxes. I do want my neighbor's kids to have the best education possible. For example, if they wanted to choose, like one of our scholarship kids, to attend the Stanford Online High School and use my tax dollars to do that, I think that makes good sense. Like, it's 2017.
Like if they homeschooled
and sure. It's 2017. I mean, it's a time when we have all of these amazing opportunities available. I want my neighbor's kids with my tax dollars to be able to do that, to be able to customize their education for their child. I mean, attending the Stanford Online High School does make perfect sense for a child if that's the right fit for them. And it makes good sense for that money to follow the child to be able to do that.
Well, and
it actually would be a cost savings too, Lauren. We can fight about that probably all day, right, about where the cost savings is and how it's marginal and what's fixed costs and what's not fixed costs, right? But maybe we should dare to go there and talk about how if my neighbor's child chooses an online program that costs just $2,000 or $5,000, you know, versus chooses to be necessarily enrolled, there's some long-term cost savings there that I, as a taxpayer, would value.
Well, and Michael, we've got a couple questions from listeners who are concerned about this, what they call diverting state money to private schools. I just read that one from Aslin. I've got another one from Anne who says, I'm not in favor of my federal, state, or local tax dollars going to private education. A couple more people have chimed in on that same point. What do other states allow, Micah, who have done this? Do they say that that is okay, or have these programs run into problems legally because of that?
Well, that is one of the big, as I think I mentioned earlier, that's one of the big concerns that people who are not as much in favor of some of these types of school choice programs, some of the concerns they have are exactly what we've been hearing is public money is being used to private schools. And one of the big concerns that people have is this is where the accountability piece comes in. And so that's definitely a big concern. And I've heard some discussion about how perhaps there are some cost savings. I mean, really the funding with these types of they call them private school choice programs, where it's your public money being used to fund education options in the private sector. And so that is a big concern for people that comes up. As far as legal challenges, they've tended to be more around the religious private schools that are sectarian and concerns around diverting money to sectarian schools. And there also been just there. I mean, we could we could jump into that discussion as well about funding. It does get pretty technical and sticky. But ultimately, there's a couple schools of thought about. On one side, you have some saying that there are in fact cost savings because often the amount of money that a student receives under these types of programs is a little bit less than the state per pupil amount. But then there are also other concerns on the other side. Some studies showing that sometimes the tax burdens behind them aren't as equally distributed, or perhaps that there are, perhaps these end up actually affecting the local school districts, regardless of what folks are saying around cost savings. So it does get kind of tricky on the private school funding, but these are things that come up quite a bit. And frankly, I just don't know that states have quite figured out how to fully grapple with some of these discussions.
Well, two big, big issues that we should jump into more: cost and accountability. And again, our Morning Edition team asked Senator John Reagan of Deerfield, he's the lead sponsor of SB 193, about this accountability issue, how much oversight there would be for students under this, that they were indeed learning what they need to learn. Let's hear how Senator Reagan responded to that.
My response would be, what kind of accountability do we have now? I mean, we have schools. You know, our schools are graded by test scores, and, you know, half the schools are doing worse than the other half. And there's nobody does anything about that at all. This is the advantage of letting the parent control the venue for the education.
What are your thoughts, Dan, on how accountable the recipients of this money would be?
So I think accountability is a serious consideration that we have to talk about. And I would just offer this thought that parents are actually the first and most important layer of accountability in public schools. This is not a program that actually differentiates in any way from that. If anybody, and I'm sure actually many people listening right now, probably those of us in the room, have relatives or friends who are teachers, we know how often they are talking with parents. They're working day to day, texting at night, talking about what's going on with that student's learning experience. So the accountability is right there. Now, on top of that, we have an additional accountability system because we want to make sure that not only are all students gaining access to educational opportunities, but actually that they're advancing their learning in a way that's going to help them thrive in the 21st century. And we know that our economy is changing all the time. We know that we compete in an international economy. And so we have accountability systems in place to make sure that our schools are providing students with learning opportunities and that students are actually advancing in a way that will deliver real economic success for the students and for our state, and that will allow students to participate and invigorate our democracy. And that looks very differently in different schools, but as a state, we also have an accountability system that involves setting rigorous and challenging standards for students. And so setting, you know, ambitious goals for every single child, because we know that every student has unlimited potential, and when challenged and given the opportunity, will rise to the occasion.
Well, we heard from Senator Reagan in that clip that, you know, again, it's so hard to say all the time students and teachers are held accountable or all the time they are not. Clearly, there's some middle ground. But we heard from Senator Reagan, you know, concerns that schools are not always held accountable. And, you know, lots of parents will tell you about one year that just did not work out for their kid, or one class or two classes that just, you know, was horrible and it just wasn't working. And, you know, maybe according to the official standards, the teacher's being held accountable. But according to your kid, you know, he or she just isn't learning anything. So it's hard to broadly say that every single teacher in every single school with every single kid is being held accountable.
And this is among the most important things that we as a society and as parents and as community members do, right? Every child's education is probably the most important thing that parents are thinking beyond the student's safety and well-being. Their education is right there, right? Top of mind every single day. Am I doing everything for my child to make sure that they're going to succeed and thrive? And so we can't have enough conversations about, are we doing that? Are we delivering on our promise that we made to students as a state? And so again, coming back to this, and I'm excited that Ms. Baker's here. I'm excited by all the callers dialing in, because we have so much opportunity in front of us. We can build on everything we've done in this state to advance educational opportunities, to create real and genuine choice for every single student.
Within the current public school system, though,
public education
you don't
system.
Like this
I think
idea.
About this way. So STEAM Ahead New Hampshire, which is a program that brings real-world science, technology, engineering, math, and arts into the classroom. It has about 120 students participating in West High School right now in Manchester. So that's 120 students whose lives are being dramatically improved by this offering. But that school has invested in 6 classrooms that are now equipped to offer this new 21st century real-world skill development. They've also invested in professional developments for the teachers to build out this new and personalized learning. Those investments are going to benefit hundreds of students in the next decade. And so that investment continues beyond the immediate classroom and sustains into the future. That's how we can be thinking about choice.
Well, one question about accountability that I had for you, Kate, and this has come up in some of the debate around this and discussion around this. Let's say that, you know, I decide to homeschool my kids and I take advantage of this $3,200 that would happen under this program. How am I protected? Maybe I'm not, from being sold, you know, supposedly the latest and greatest textbook or educational software, and it turns out to be poor quality at best. Maybe it's a scam. I mean, when schools purchase educational materials, there's professionals who assess that. As a parent, you know, how do I avoid being scammed by someone who's saying, look, Laura, this is great software. Spend your $3,200 on this.
So my coworker actually was a homeschooler and is a Parent Information Center PIC certified counselor, and she does love to answer families' questions and help them with that.
They also do resources out there.
Yes,
they
also also are submitting to us the receipts so that we can see what they're purchasing with the homeschool scholarships that we currently offer, and we do love to help people to be able to get to that point. Speaking about accountability, you know, the homeschool law, I brought it here. It's about 5 pages. You know, people that homeschool do have a certified teacher do a portfolio analysis every year and or take a standardized test. In addition to that, our independent schools in New Hampshire really are all doing that already also, where they're doing standardized tests. For example, some of them are doing the NEWAs. The high schools are definitely doing the SATs. Some of them are doing the Terra Nova. They are doing that exact same accountability measure internally. In addition, they have the additional accountability where, frankly, if a parent is not happy, they probably would leave the school, and so and possibly re-enroll in their, you know, neighborhood public school. For example, my daughter does attend Bedford High School, Laura, as you know. She's a straight-A student there, and that is a school that works great for her, and we love it. But if it wasn't working for us, we might make a different change, right, and choose something else. It has the same impact in the other direction, where a family that is unhappy with their you know, private school or the education provider that they're choosing could leave. You know, they're interested in more than just test scores, basically, and the private schools are providing that currently also.
Under this bill, Kate, would somebody be watching to make sure that this money was spent appropriately? Not only that the parents were getting information about, you know, the best resources so that they weren't scammed by some company, but also that the parents were using it in a way that most people would find appropriate. For example, what if I said, my kids are really interested in marine science. We're going to go to the Caribbean and snorkel and study marine science. And that, you know, let's use the $3,200 to pay for those plane tickets. I mean, somebody's got to be watching out for stuff like that.
Yes,
right?
There's 2 separate pieces to this. One is a company called Benefit Wallet, which does provide a debit card that is restricted, like a health savings account or an EBT card, where the codes of education providers can be entered. And so the purchases can only be used at education providers themselves.
I see.
There's another piece where they could get an expense pre-approved if it wasn't a specifically coded education provider. So I feel like that piece is built in to it. The point ultimately is to empower families to customize the education for their child. So we are trusting them that they do, and in our experience, parents do have their child's best interest at heart, and people particularly that choose to homeschool, I mean, those people are dedicating an entire person to their child's education every day. I mean, I'm not even doing that, right? And so they really are have their child's best interest and do want to do. We haven't seen any cases of education expenses come through that have been strange at all.
Well, and heading into a break, a couple more emails that I'll share with you. Mark says, I wish I'd had this ESA program when my children were in school. It sounds great. The more choices for parents, the better. And then we've got Barbara who says, how can we talk about vouchers and choice when we can't even afford to have kindergarten in every school? Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
It's not a reaction they can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah. This week on Something Wild, prepare for the heebie-jeebies.
Garter snakes are more cold tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. And winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
Chris Martin has the 411 on our slithering neighbors. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild, wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, cool stuff.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how the school choice debate is playing out here and around the country. In particular, we're looking at efforts to set up what are called education freedom savings accounts. A House committee today gets to work on a Senate bill that would set up these accounts. We're finding out more and taking your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Kate Baker, Executive Director of the Children's Scholarship Fund NH, Dan Vallone, Director of Engagement for Reaching Higher NH, and Micah Wixom, Policy Analyst for the Education Commission of the States. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Barbara's in Henniker. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning. Morning to everybody. I've been sitting here really enjoying all this conversation. First of all, I'm a retired school nurse of 27 years. Second of all, I'm a retired educator, retired legislator of 20 years. I am a strong supporter of public schools. I really believe, and I've been around while we for the years that we've been going through this whole process, I really believe that we need to make sure that our public schools are the best they can be. I firmly believe that if our public schools had the resources they need, we'd be able to meet most of the needs that you're talking about.
So why now, do you feel, Barbara, that this does not help the public schools be the best they can be?
Well, they're going to divert all kinds of money. I was at the hearing last week when the superintendents and mobs of people came in and expressed all kinds of concerns. It isn't that I don't care about these children. I do. But we talk about the fact that I would like to talk about the fact that children are different. When I first went to work in Concord, we had like a handful of students in the whole school system who had health problems, who had emotional problems, who had learning problems. When I left the school, there were 200 issues. Kids had issues in the junior high alone.
Coming in with greater issues. And we've done a bunch of reporting in earlier shows, Barbara, on that point. So I appreciate it that schools are more and more seeing kids with challenges and more being asked to work as social workers. So I'll refer listeners to that past coverage. But to your point, Barbara, about diversion, this did come up a lot at the hearing, that if you gave the adequacy grants to the parents directly, that the concern is that this would be diverting money away from the public schools. Let's hear Senator Reagan again talking with our Morning Edition team. He's pushing back on the concern that this would hurt public education and specifically public education funding.
The schools claim that you're taking resources from them just doesn't bear up. If a student doesn't go to their school, and there's many students in a school district that do not attend the school district school, the school's hasn't lost anything. Any business has an ebb and flow in the amount of their business, and they have to adapt to that.
So, Dan Vallone, what about that? You know, if my kid isn't going to Concord High anymore, then and his $3,500, you know, follows him somewhere else, then Concord High doesn't have to educate him anymore. So why do they need his $3,500?
Well, I think that, and I'll admit that I'm not fully certain I understand all of what Senator Reagan was saying there. So I won't try and respond to anything that he said. But broadly speaking, we invest in our schools to try and provide as many opportunities for as many students as possible. And so we don't assign numbers to students in the sense of saying, hey, this is the value of one student. We think about, what outcomes do we want for our student? We get the ideas right first, and then we think about the resources that we need to support those ideas. And I think that this SB 193 addresses education in a very different perspective. It does look at it from a numbers first perspective. And it says, this is what we think of as the value of educating a student, writes the number down, and then that's it. That's the end of the experience between the state, our communities, and the students. I think if we focus instead on supporting and enhancing the traditional New Hampshire way about investing in local communities, we see more opportunities develop. And I think an important here to talk about with SB 193 is that you think about where is this money coming from? And it comes from the Education Trust Fund. About a third of that consists of local property taxes in the form of the statewide education property tax. And that, in my mind, really speaks to how education in New Hampshire is such a local issue. It is deeply invested communities coming together year and year and year over year to talk about what they need in their school.
So, but just to now, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, please, on the finances, these education savings account would only grab from the state portion. So, if I pulled my kid from Concord High and used this, Concord High would still get the local portion of his funding, so to speak. I would only be accessing the state portion.
But the school receives those dollars merged together, right? So a school doesn't delineate this is state money, this is local money. It is simply the budget that a school has. And while they can itemize that way, and it does, the one issue with this bill is that it does force local communities to send their local property tax dollars potentially outside of their district. New Hampshire is, so one of the interesting things about New Hampshire is we rank number one or number two basically on every measure of academic achievement in the country. If you look at state by state, if you look at SAT scores, graduation rates, everything. One of the few areas where New Hampshire ranks actually towards the bottom of the country is in state support for education. So local control is not just a deeply held philosophy in New Hampshire, it's an economic reality. And we should respect that. That's why we see so much innovation in our state is because because Epping is going to do something different from Concord, from Berlin, from Pittsfield, from Keene. All of it is empowered to do different things for their students.
Here's an email from Justin who says, school choice is a backdoor way of privatizing public education. When private entities take public monies, they are thinking in terms of cost savings to their shareholders. History tells us that this translates into lower wages for master's levels professionals and teachers, less resources for students, more monies devoted to marketing than to school resources, no health benefits, no employee rights, and likely employees at these private institutions ultimately may be labeled as 1099. Contract workers. And there's a lot more here. Justin, I'm sorry, I can't read the whole thing. But Micah, could you just shine a light on how the other states have wrestled with this issue of if you do take some public money for these education savings accounts, are you or are you not hurting the public school system in that district? How have other states sort of wrestled with that?
I don't know that there's a really good conclusive answer to that, because I think this is an ongoing question in many states that have these types of private school choice programs. I do want to point out in this discussion of funding, first of all, I need to preface what I'm about to say with, so education savings accounts are a form of a very similar to a voucher. However, they've not been around very long. And so most of the research, there's really very little research on education savings accounts specifically. Most of the research we have is on straight voucher programs, which allows just allows students to attend a private school, whereas education savings accounts have a broader array of educational services that are available to the parents. So having said that, there has been a little bit of research on funding for voucher programs. And on one, as I mentioned earlier, on one side there are discussions about how there are cost savings, but there has been evidence that there is evidence that these voucher programs do in fact affect state and local budgets, even if there are some cost savings because the voucher amount is sometimes less than the per pupil amount. There is some evidence that they do affect districts or states in some ways.
Affect but them how? Like more money or less money?
Just less money, typically. They end up having a little bit less money, so it just affects the budgeting a little bit. And this tends to be, and I'm sorry, I can't get into too much more detail because it tends to be very specific on how a state's funding formula is structured.
Sure, and they're also
different.
Which
is very different in every state.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give you all the numbers. Also because school finance is not my forte, but there is evidence that it does, in fact, affect state and local budgets. But again, it kind of depends on how much, and that may be offset by the fact that the voucher amount is sometimes less than the state pupil account. So it's really a tricky question, and as I said, I don't know that there's a conclusive answer on how states are wrestling with this, because I don't think any state has come to a definitive decision.
Sure. The diversion concern, though, you're saying, has been real. The concern has been real. whether or not it's borne out by the actual numbers. Can you jump in on that, too? We've gotten a lot of people emailing saying, why are you pulling money from public schools?
I think I can answer this in a way that is not polarized, okay? I'd like to answer it very authentically, right? And so, like Carl Ladd was saying when he was on last time, okay, there's some fixed costs and there's some variable costs, right?
Within a school.
Yes. So if you only move a few children, it doesn't really change the cost very much, right? And so that's what she's saying. And that's true, okay? I'm not going to say it always saves money, right? If you only have one child leaving a classroom that needs something different, that the cost of that classroom might not change.
Right, you can't slice, you know, 1/20th of the teacher.
Correct. They were talking about putting in, some of the legislators were talking about in this putting in caps or like stabilization grants that might go to the districts. If too many children left, for example, they would send money. And I actually said, don't do that because there could be a long range savings that then you would be ignoring, right? So yes, there might be short term costs where the fixed costs and the variable costs don't necessarily change. But in the long run, there might be some cost savings, but that would depend on the districts responding. You know, for example, student population is declining in New Hampshire by like 10% per year. And so it's
as the state ages.
Am I wrong? No, let Dan say what the number is.
2% decline in enrollment.
Depends on the community.
Depends on the community, right? Because we also have some schools where
there's a line to get out the door.
Right? Families are making this decision to. Yeah.
So the question is, would they respond to it, okay, right? If there were a number of students that moved to a different town, how would the school district respond? That's where the fiscal savings could or might not be.
It sounds like from you, Kate, and also from what Micah told us, it's still uncertain. So we'll set that aside for the moment. Oh, go ahead, Micah.
If I may jump in. Yeah, one thing I think is also important to keep in mind is it's a little hard to pin down exact numbers. But nationally, there are actually relatively very few students who end up participating in these types of private school choice programs, whether it's education savings accounts or tax credit scholarships or voucher programs. Again, that will depend, of course, on the state, maybe even on the district. But nationally, you see, I mean, it's really just a drop in the bucket. By some estimates, it's less than 500,000 nationally. Again, that will be a little different depending on the state. But I think that's also important to keep in mind is overall, we're talking about a pretty small population of students who actually end up participating in these programs.
So despite all the debate and all the conversation, and we've done a gazillion shows on topics like this, Micah, you're saying not that many people actually end up doing it. Most people just stick with the way it is.
Yeah, and of course it does depend. So if you have a state like Florida, you might end up with more students participating. And of course, not every state has these types of programs. But overall, we are talking about pretty small numbers.
I'd like to get one or two more calls in if we could. And Rui is in Brookline. Hi, Rui. Go ahead.
Well, it's good timing because this is basically one of the points I wanted to make. I mean, we're looking at $15,000 per student as the average cost for educating students in public school in New Hampshire. And then, you know, whereas if you pull a student out of the public school, they're getting only $3,000 or so back. So, of course, if there's a mass exodus from these schools, you know, we're going to have to look at possibly downsizing the school or things like that. But if it is just a trickle, then what we're looking at is really a win-win situation where, you know, where now there's more funds available for the students that remain, or that money could then be credited back to the taxpayers in the next you know, the next year when the property tax rate is set again, or a combination of both. It's really up to the town. So it gives more school choice to the public schools and more school choice to the school choice camp as well.
Well, thank you, Rui, for the call. And this is kind of what we were talking about earlier, Dan, where, you know, he's right. Average cost, I think, is about $15,000. $3,200-ish of that comes from the state and the rest comes from the local district. So, again, it's the example before of, you know, if a couple kids leave, the school misses out on that, might miss out on that state adequacy grant, but it's not missing out on the whole kahuna there.
Well, and it speaks to, and we talked about earlier, how there are a variety of costs that schools would still have to maintain, and that would mean that the students who remain in the school have fewer options, have larger classes, have fewer extracurricular activities. But even more broadly, look at the idea. This is pretty antithetical to how we approach education in New Hampshire. This would be forcing local communities to use their local tax dollars in a way that they didn't provide input on. In New Hampshire, we come at this from the local community perspective. Education is first and foremost done at the community level, coming together and saying, What do we want to have for our kids? What do we need to have to make sure they're going to succeed? And then we find the resources to do it. This has a very different approach that I think that we should be very concerned about before implementing. And to something that Micah suggested earlier, no state has had a universal program implemented. So this would be an experiment.
Universal meaning just about anybody
statewide,
can get the money.
No
in most other states, it's, you know, you have to have an IEP
Correct.
Or some sort of a disability Right. and Right. so forth. So too open-ended in your mind.
It's an experiment.
Would you feel better about it if it were, you know, Dan, if it were a little more restricted towards, you know, those kids who have more educational challenges?
I don't see what problem we're solving when we have the opportunity to invest in creating actual real choice that will benefit every single student. We can do that. We are doing it across the state. It looks differently in different communities because that's the nature of New Hampshire education. But let's double down on that. Let's make what we have here even better.
Well, go ahead, Mike. I heard you wanted to jump in there, and then Kate, go ahead.
Yeah, and if I just may clarify, and he's right, it is true that no state has implemented a universal voucher, but I did want to clarify, Nevada technically has one, even though it's not been implemented. And Arizona's program was started with a very limited scope. And almost, I call it concept creep. Almost every year, it seems they've expanded eligibility. So it actually has relatively broad eligibility as it stands now. And then they recently, within the past couple of weeks, signed into law that it will be universally eligible, but that will be phased in over a few years. So he's right that it hasn't been implemented, but there has something along the lines of universal eligibility has certainly been in the works for a while.
So, Kate, last question for you, sure. Real quick, and there's so much in this bill that we haven't even gotten to yet, but there's something in here called a role for a scholarship organization that would get 5% of the money for what the bill calls administrative expenses. 5% is small, but it's not minuscule. That's extra money that a parent could use. So what is this scholarship organization and why does it need 5%?
The reason for doing that is the best practices that they've seen in Florida. For example, families need that consultative level, like we talked about earlier, helping them and leading them towards, you know, being able to figure out what is the right thing to choose for their children. And so with this way, it creates less cost and less bureaucracy while also providing the opportunity to have an organization that helps families.
All right. Well, we're going to see what the House does with this. It might change what the Senate did. And then we'll have you guys back. We'll talk about it again.
Great. Always look forward to it.
Micah, thank you so much for joining us from out there in Colorado. We really appreciate
it. You're welcome. And thank you for having me.
That's Micah Wixom, policy analyst for the Education Commission of the States. Dan Vallone, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Very nice to meet you as well. Thank you for having me.
Dan Vallone, he's with Reaching Higher NH. And Kate Baker, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
Kate Baker, executive director of the Children's Scholarship Fund NH. And our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.